We'll call the meeting to order. First off, thank you all so much to the members, also to the folks that came in to join us today. Happy Thanksgiving to the extent that I missed that holiday with you. Nobody invited me over this year, so I was a little disappointed. But I really genuinely appreciate you coming in during the interim. I try not to do that too often. But this issue is one that seemed very, very critical to members of this committee after the last hearing. And since there have been some significant developments that have been taking place since the last time we got together, it seemed like a good opportunity to get this group together and give a little follow-up. It is obviously an important issue to all of us, not just because of the auto dealers that have been set for wind down, but to those many, many families. I had a chance to stop at one dealership. They employ, I think it was 80 to 90, 85 people, something like that. And they're good paying jobs. They're the type of job that you can, you know, have health insurance with and support a family and pay a mortgage. So they really are a big deal. With that, we've got a few folks that have asked to testify, and then we'd be happy to hear from anybody else that might desire to be heard. First up is Alyssa Shalander from the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Welcome back.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members. As you said, my name is Alyssa Shalander. I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. The Auto Dealers Association is, of course, the trade association for auto dealers who have franchises to sell new cars and trucks. And today we've been asked to give the committee just a little bit of a follow-up from the October 1st hearing, in which we discussed the issue of dealership terminations. The last time we were together, I told you that 60 Minnesota dealerships were given termination notices by General Motors and Chrysler, which resulted in almost 3,500 lost jobs here in Minnesota. We'll probably see a few more dealership closures if no buyer can be found for Saab, so we'll be up a few more, you know, probably another 100 or so employees with those closures as well. You know, and as I said last time, the most important thing about that is that those were unnecessary job losses, that those are businesses that were neither failing or in need of a bailout, really just due to the bankruptcy law that allowed them to just be wiped out. So, as you know, GM and Chrysler went through bankruptcy in roughly May and June of this year. And the bankruptcy allowed them to terminate Chrysler dealers and to amend their dealer contracts with General Motors dealers that they wanted to go forward and impose new terms on the folks that they wanted to wipe out, which have lovingly become known as the wind-down dealers in the GM world. Soon after the dust from bankruptcy had settled and we sort of knew, you know, who was in and who was out, the wind-down dealers and terminated dealers from across the country organized themselves and went to Congress to seek some federal action to undo what was done during the bankruptcy. We successfully garnered 42 co-sponsors in the U.S. Senate and 287 co-sponsors in the U.S. House. And I am proud to say that all 10 members of Minnesota's congressional delegation bipartisanly signed on to the federal legislation, which would have automatically reinstated the terminated dealers, and it would have also provided additional compensation for those dealers who didn't wish to pursue reinstatement but really just wanted to get their bills paid. needless to say, though, the federal legislation was an uphill battle. To ask Congress to, undo what the bankruptcy court had done was quite a feat. And soon after the August recess of Congress, our advocates in the Congress asked the dealers and the manufacturers to sit down and try to negotiate a non-legislative alternative to the dealership termination. And that is exactly what we did. Those at the negotiating table were told by members of Congress that they were expected to keep these negotiations private, that they did not want to see these negotiations played out in the headlines or in email chains, and so that's exactly what happened. For 3 months, they were really closed-door negotiations. And the last time we were together here at the Commerce Committee, the only thing I was really able to tell you is that the negotiations were happening and that we had really no idea whether progress was being made. Well, as it turned out, after 3 months of sitting in closed-door negotiations in Washington, D.C., progress was not being made. Just over a week ago, General Motors and Chrysler walked out on those negotiations and issued public statements unilaterally that basically said that the dealers could have an arbitrator review the decisions that were made by Chrysler and GM as long as it was based on the same flawed criteria that was originally created by GM and Chrysler. As you can imagine, the dealers didn't really think that that was really much of a satisfactory outcome. So the dealers went back to our advocates in the Congress and asked them to give us something, pass a bit of language that would give us a lifeline. And it was not going to be possible to automatically reinstate every terminated dealer. There was vocal opposition from the Obama White House. And so what happened was the congressional advocates were able to revamp some language in the financial services bill, which provided the dealers with what we hope to be a fair arbitration for each terminated dealership. The language was recently passed. Just last Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a financial services bill containing our legislation, and on Sunday, just 2 days ago, the U.S. Senate passed it. So still very fresh in our minds.
They knew we had this hearing.
That's true. That is. So, assuming the president signs the bill,
he knows about the hearing too.
He does. He does.
So I'm sure
he's probably, didn't do it this
he's
morning.
He's signing it right now.
Assuming he signs the bill soon, the dealers, the terminated dealers, will have 40 days to decide whether they want to pursue the arbitration as it's laid out in the federal legislation. The arbitration then has to be completed by June of 2010, so we should have these wrapped up in the next 6 months. So the new federal law will allow the dealer and the manufacturer to present any relevant information to an arbitrator, and the arbitrator is directed to balance the economic interests of both the manufacturer, the dealer, and the public at large. The law requires the arbitrator to consider at least 7 criteria, and I'll just let you know what they are. If you'll just allow me to read the list. The arbitrator has to look at the dealer's profitability in the years 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009. Has to look at the manufacturer's business plan, the dealer's current economic viability, the dealer's satisfaction of his or her performance objectives pursuant to their franchise agreement. Demographic and geographic characteristics of the dealer's market area. The dealer's performance in relation to the criteria that was laid out by the manufacturer in their determination to terminate. And also, they have to factor in the length of experience of the dealer. So, at the end of the day, we didn't get the automatic reinstatements or the additional compensation that we were seeking. We still believe that's what the terminated dealers are all entitled to. But we hope that the process that's laid out in the federal arbitration statute will be a fair one, and one that hopefully will result in saving some of the 3,500 jobs that we lost this year. The next question really for the terminated dealers is going to be whether they can afford to prepare for the arbitration. Yesterday there was an article in Automotive News that said that some dealers can expect to spend up to $100,000 or more on legal fees and professional services to prepare to make their presentations to this arbitrator. You know, and that, again, is a process that it has no guarantees of reinstatement. The dealers that have been terminated are also concerned by what appears to be an intent by East General Motors to reestablish dealerships in market areas where they terminated a dealer. So there are dealers right now that are currently being invited to make proposals and compete for businesses that they should really already rightfully own. The dealers lucky enough not to be terminated are going forward being asked to make some pretty significant additional investments and sacrifices with a whole lot of risk than they ever had before. And I guess in closing, Mr. Chair, I would just summarize that I think that the general feeling most of these dealers, both go forward dealers and terminated dealers, is we just do not understand how these companies can justify eliminating the people who are producing the profits while they seem to have an endless supply of resources to continue to fight with the people who really just want to do nothing more than sell the product for them. So, Mr. Chair, I have with me today Lee and Karen Carlson from Maine Motors and Anoka, and they would like to just tell you their story briefly about what their experience has been like over the last several months. So I'll turn it over to them.
If I might, just one quick thought with respect to the arbitrator. How is the arbitrator selected under the federally passed legislation? To the extent we know at this point, it's probably on page 397 of the financial services package bill that's going to the president. But
yeah, Mr. Chair, the language says the arbitrator shall be selected from the list of qualified arbitrators maintained by the regional office of the American Arbitration Association in the region where the dealership is located.
That is certainly satisfactory to me. The AAA is a very well-regarded entity, and their arbitrators are known for being unbiased. So, thank you. And with that, Mr. and Ms. Carlson, whoever wants to go first.
First off, I'd like to sincerely thank Representative Joe Adkins and his committee, as it's represented here today, and all the help that they've given us and concern that they've shown. And it's been very gratifying. And I'm sure I'm not just speaking for myself, but for all the dealers that have been participating in this event. I just have a few written comments that I will comment on. You heard three other dealers at your last session, and they told their stories, and ours is very similar. I will try to hit on a few different topics that I think are relevant to the state of Minnesota and how we operate. So I'll start here. After 90 years in business, I can't believe I'm sitting here today fighting for what is already mine. It was earned over these many years by dedication and hard work. At Maine Motor, Chevrolet, Cadillac, and Anoka, we have survived several wars, the Great Depression, the oil embargo, 21% interest rates, the decline of General Motors, and I could go on and on. And believe it or not, we are still profitable. What we haven't survived was the Auto Task Force and the General Motors bankruptcy, even though we surpassed all their criteria, at least the criteria that we have seen so far. It seems to be changing. What the government and GM have done is wrong. How could this happen in America? With unemployment at around 10%, what sense does it make to close profitable dealerships who employ hundreds of Americans? And if you add it up, I'm sure it's in the thousands. The dealer does not cost the factory or government money, quite the contrary. We are the retail customer, we make them money. Who else sells their cars and trucks and buys their parts, along with a lot of other services? Maine Motors has been in business, as I said earlier, for 90 years, since 1919. Coincidentally, that's the same year GMAC was formed with General Motors. We sold and serviced GM cars and trucks all these years. I did a quick calculation yesterday, which is not very accurate possibly, but I would guess that it's pretty close to the fact that we have sold over 60,000 cars and trucks in that length of time for that company. Like everybody else in our business, we've invested millions in our facility. Our sales in 2008, I'm not really excited to say, were $32 million. If you want to call in the heydays when General Motors had 50-some percent of the market, our sales were generally in the range of $60 to $70 million. In 2008, we had 80 employees, and of course, all with the usual benefits and retirement plans. Our total payroll for 2008 was just under $4 million. Our vehicle sales tax, the excise tax paid in 2008, was $1,200,000. The federal income tax withheld from us in 2008 was $455,000. State income tax withheld was $183,000. Employer payroll taxes paid in 2008 were a little over $265,000. Real estate taxes paid in 2008 were $150,000. And we have over 60 vendors we do business with, and we pay them approximately around $2 million per year for their goods and services. And that, all of that is during a recession. Some of you believe government shouldn't be involved, and yet the government did involve themselves when they set up the auto task force and bailed out GM and Chrysler. Since when is it right that the government and take away a private business in the United States of America? I had a friend once that always kidded his wife and said, "How can I miss you if you don't go away?" We will probably go away, and you might not miss us because with the budgets that the state of Minnesota is confronted with, our figures are probably pretty pale in comparison. But I know all of you understand and realize that if all the dealers that are rejected do go away, you will miss it. And the question is now, who will then take up the slack? And I'm afraid I'm looking at everybody in the room here who will have to take up the slack along with us. With that, I'll turn it over to my wife, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Carlson?
I need my glasses too, I'm sorry to say. Thank you so much for asking us, and it's our pleasure. Thank you for everything that you are doing to help us. Today, I would like to address the termination of our large dealership, May Motors, in relationship to the criteria set by General Motors. On September 30th, 2009, Brian Lee from General Motors sent to your committee the criteria used to select dealers for termination. We were terminated in the second wave, so we couldn't have been too bad. In fact, in light of his criteria, we weren't bad at all. According to GM's scorecard, we passed with flying colors. Our DPS, or DART, or dealer performance score, is 91.31 for 2008. Brian Lee told Lee Carlson the reason we were terminated was because of our sales performance. We all know the DPS is a composite score of the dealer's entire performance. It is the total score weighted according to GM standards, which cannot depict the parts section by section. The criteria does not say a dealer must have 70 in every area. It is a well-known fact that many chosen dealers had neither a DPS score of 70 and certainly not in every section. When I was in college and you took a semester course and the professor said, "Class, we will have four tests. The final will be worth 50, the midterm 30, and the other two are worth 10%. And if you got a 91.31 average, the professor couldn't say, "Karen, you only got 63 on the final. You don't pass." The dealer's area of responsibility has always been subject to discussion and argued about. This, of course, plays a big part in your sales score. For instance, we have a large area across the Mississippi River. It is almost impossible at some times to get across the bridge coming to Main Motor. When our son was in charge, he had problems with General Motors. We fired him and replaced him with ourselves. We also replaced most of the management team. At no time were we ever warned about losing the dealership according to state franchise laws. In fact,
When we came back, we went immediately to our zone manager and told him what we were going to do. He and the rep came out and we ordered every car and truck we could get our hands on. In 2008, we sold 534 new cars and trucks. They consistently told us over the next 13 months we were doing a great job, right up to the day we were terminated. This is proven by our performance. In the first 5 months of 2009, our sales performance was enormous as we hit 105% of our sales objectives. This was in light of the declining sales performance of General Motors. Our percent change versus the prior year was minus 15%. Many go-forward dealers were down as much as minus 60%. Isn't it strange that these all-important DART or DPS scores cannot be obtained for 2009? Even now, it's December, when we used to get them every quarter. As Jack Fitzgerald said, a good performing dealership is one that can make a profit and keep people employed through this difficult recession. After all, General Motors and Chrysler went bankrupt. GM said they had to cut dealers to become profitable. Don't they have to sell more cars to do that? Dealers are their only customer, their only producer. How does it make sense to cut someone who sells almost 600 new cars and trucks in a year with downtime? Our area is large and needs Chevrolet representation. 2 to 5 miles from us sits Toyota, Nissan, Buick, GMC, Ford, Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep. Do you think our customers will drive by all those to the nearest Chevrolet dealership 30 minutes away? I would like to close with a word about the dealer, my husband, Lee Carlson. In 1992, he was selected Minnesota Time Magazine Quality Dealer of the Year, and he placed number 2 nationally. This year, he is our state representative again. The Dealer of the Year program was originated to call attention to new car dealers in America who exhibit exceptional performance in their dealerships, combined with distinguished community service to create a positive public relations forum for all new car dealers. Maine Motors needs to stay, and there is no one more qualified or respected than Lee Carlson, the present dealer. The chairman has been so helpful to us, I would like to address his latest response from General Motors regarding Maine Motor. There's just a couple of things. This latest response is full of inaccuracies. Since when are we graded just on our RSI sales score? I have two documents that say it is the total DPS score. One General Motors gave to the federal government and one to your committee. The criteria is identical in both. They are changing the rules as they go. And which year's scores are you using? I was told 2008. However, may I read my GPS scores for the last 9 years? 2008, 91. 2007, 106. 2006, 87. 2005, 91. 2004, 118. And 2003, 116. 2002, 115. 2001, 121, and 2000, 129. According to my math, all of these are considerably over their required 70. Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed being here, and thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And Representative Abler, by the way, welcome to the committee. We have a special celebrity guest, Representative Abler. You represent these folks, don't you?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I can, and I want to thank you for your attention to this tremendous part of the Anoka community, and they have been there 90 years, longer than I've been there. Thank goodness.
Mr. Carlson doesn't look a year over like 45 or something. I don't...
Well, when I saw you working on this, I couldn't be happier, and I expressed that to you in an email. And they are everything that they say. They provide jobs. They're good employers. They're the trusted name in town in that little part of the area. They're just part of the landscape. And thank you for doing all you can do. And you know, there's a time to get rid of some bad apples and some weak performers. This is neither a bad apple, it's a very strong performer. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler. And I'm guessing that members of the committee will probably have questions or concerns that they want to raise. I do want to take the testimony from the witnesses that have signed up, so we'll do that. I also want to remind you, and I'm sure it's still in your mind, we had a number of dealers that testified before us last time. And this is just one more example, but certainly this isn't meant to minimize or forget about the testimony that we heard from many of the dealers last time, many of whom I know are in the room once again, and I appreciate that as well. With that, we do have Mr. Perry from General Motors. And having come on down, Mr. Perry, as hard as I've been on the manufacturers, I do want to share a compliment with them, which is that since this committee took it upon itself after the last hearing to share our concerns with the manufacturers, General Motors has been relatively strong in their response. We may not necessarily like what we hear or agree with what we hear, but they have been responsive to the requests. I suggested to them that they have a person here. They agreed to do that. I know that there was probably some trepidation about sending somebody into the lion's den or something. Maybe that's how it was perceived. I hope not. But I've been on the phone with them a number of times on behalf of numerous dealers, not just the Carlsons, but I want to compliment them for sending Mr. Perry and for being as responsive as they have been. Now with that, be ready for some tough questions. So anyway, Mr. Perry.
Great. Thank you, Chairman Atkins, members of the committee. As the Chairman said, my name is Jeff Perry, and I do appreciate the opportunity to be here today representing General Motors and to take the opportunity to discuss GM's restructuring of its retail dealer network with the committee. Let me begin by saying that GM does recognize how difficult and painful this bankruptcy process has been for all parties involved, and in this case, especially the affected dealers. However, the bankruptcy process, as we all know, was a course of last resort to withstand the worst global economic recession in nearly a century. The old General Motors found itself facing a dramatically contracting automobile sales market, and all the while supporting an unsustainable level of debt and a business structure that no longer matched today's competitive realities. A bankruptcy and an equally dramatic restructuring of our entire business was absolutely necessary to avoid a much darker economic scenario of liquidation that would have resulted in the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs, not just at the corporate level, but at the dealer level as well. We were forced to address all aspects of our business operations, beginning with the manufacturing footprint through the number of brands and models that we offered. We looked at salaried and hourly employment levels, benefits, retiree costs, suppliers, and of course we had no choice but to also address the serious issues that faced us through our legacy dealer network. GM's dealer restructuring is an integral aspect of our viability plan because many of the dealerships now operate today in outdated facilities that are no longer located where they can best serve our customers. It should be noted that most of our GM dealer network was largely established in the late 1940s and early 1950s before the development of the United States Interstate Highway System at a time when General Motors held nearly half of the auto industry. In recent years, with GM's market share falling into the 20s, many of our GM dealers cannot earn enough profit to renovate their facilities and were unable to retain top-tier sales and service staff. At the same time, General Motors was incurring substantial costs to support an inefficient and uncompetitive dealer network and to keep pace with the imports that support themselves half of the number of stores that GM has been supporting, and therefore their dealers were able to nearly double the throughput in their facilities. A right-sized dealer network built around strong dealers will allow dealers to earn the profits that are necessary to modernize their facilities and compete aggressively in their market to attract and retain top-tier sales and service staff. A strong and profitable dealer network can also help position General Motors to provide the industry's best customer service and enhance our image of our four remaining brands, Chevrolet, Cadillac, Buick, and GMC. GM's remaining dealerships will be better positioned to serve their current GM customers and more capable of aggressively marketing to attract new customers away from the competition. To obtain a restructured dealer network, GM identified and notified its dealers based on performance criteria that would not be renewing their sales and service agreement at the end of the term of their agreement in October 2010. The dealers then signed wind-down agreements that committed General Motors to provide each of those dealers with specific compensation, and depending on the outcome of the sale of Saab and the pending sales of Saab and Hummer, the total compensation for all of those dealers will total to approximately $600 million. To date, GM has already paid many of these we've paid the wind down dealers to date nearly 25% of that sum, or about $150 million in wind down payments. The rest of that amount is to be paid as the dealers terminate their sales and service agreements between now and October 2010. We do certainly recognize the critical role that our dealers play in satisfying the customers and their importance to the communities across the country. As Mr. Lander pointed out, there were dealers that asked and lobbied in Congress to get Congress involved in helping them with their efforts toward reinstatement. And I might add that she did a very good job explaining how that legislation has played out and what we have today. For many weeks, GM has been meeting with federal legislators and various groups that represent the dealers in an effort to develop a mutually agreeable non-legislative solution that will address the concerns of the wind-down dealers. And just this week, Congress passed, and the President is expected to sign federal legislation that creates a process for the wind-down dealers to make their case for reinstatement before a third-party arbitrator, which would be binding. If signed into law by the President, we will carefully review that legislation and determine the best course of action to take. Keeping in mind, of course, that we believe that all parties share a commitment to move forward to create a stronger, more profitable, and a competitive dealer network that is critical to our mutual success. Thank you for your time, and I'll try to answer any questions that I can.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. And I don't want to close off further testimony, but I do want to give those for the folks that were scheduled to testify. I'd like to take some questions and concerns from members to sort of get a flavor of where things are at, and then we'll see if we have a chance to take a little bit more testimony. That said, we do have another hearing scheduled for 2:30, so I want to try to make sure that we're moving along. Representative Davis, I know I had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this hearing today, and a couple of questions for Mr. Perry. I was recently up in the Anoka area, in the city of Anoka, Champlin, up in that area, and it seems to me to be just driving around there, a pretty solid, high-growth area. My question is, the Main Motors serviced quite an area there. Who is going to service that area now? I mean, Anoka is a vibrant, strong community. They've got a great state representative. I think they're on the move forward. Who is going to serve the people of Anoka for their Chevy needs?
Mr. Chair, to answer the question, to I guess address everybody on those types of questions right up front. I personally was not involved in any of the dealership restructuring efforts. I wasn't involved in any of the dealer decisions that were made, and I'm only vaguely familiar in this particular case with some of the numbers that Main Motors had. I'm not going, because I was on a phone call last Friday with Chairman Atkins. So unfortunately, I don't know what the plans are or how that's being planned.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and to Mr. Perry, I'm not saying that you did make the decisions or anything like that. I'm just wondering, that's a very vibrant area, Anoka, Champlin, that whole area up there. And now they don't have their Chevy dealer. Who's going to service? Somebody mentioned something about having to drive 30 miles away. I've also heard stories that where there's dealers being cut, now GM is recruiting new dealers in that area, and they're not the existing profitable dealers that they had previously. So the question is, I mean, somebody must know what's going to happen. That's a profitable dealership in an area that GM would want to be represented in. Who's going to serve that area? And you're saying you don't know.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know those details.
Can we ask perhaps a little bit more general term? And I mentioned on the phone call with the folks on Friday that whoever they sent here on their behalf, that I didn't expect them to know the specifics of every individual dealership. We've got 60 individual dealers, over 3,000 employees at stake just here in Minnesota. So I appreciate your joining us. I don't necessarily expect you to know every individual set of circumstances, but the question in general terms, I know that there's another example in Rochester. There's a variety of other examples of where there's been a wind down taking place, and at the same time, there's this invitation that's being sent out to potential creators or new owners to put in a dealership. Why is it that you wind one down and then invite in their place, when you've already had one, have somebody new come in? If you can answer that in at least general terms, I think that would help the committee get their head around what you're up to.
I'll do my best. I mean, again, I'm not involved at that level with our restructuring of the dealer network. I was specifically chosen, I guess, to come here. The person that would actually normally represent this area from General Motors was tied up in a meeting that he couldn't get out of. I am actually one of General Motors, for purposes of meetings with the dealers group, what they're terming as a franchise expert using that term a little bit loosely, but they're franchise expert on with the franchise legislation. So that's sort of how I was selected, not because of my specific knowledge about how we were doing the restructuring.
And that's fair enough. I'm guessing, though, that question has probably been posed about 1,000 times, and you've been in a room or someplace nearby and heard the answer. So if you can share with us what Jim's response is.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's a fair question, and I think to the extent that I could answer it, I don't know what the reasoning would be, and I couldn't speak to that as to why we would close a particular dealer or wind down a dealer and then turn around in an area and say, okay, now it's open to everybody. I'm sure that there is a reason for that sits within the overall process. Now, beyond that, it's my understanding that the dealer that was in that area was also offered the opportunity to make a similar proposal for that point, if a point is going back into the same area.
So you get to bid on keeping your own business open that's been told to be closed. I'm sorry, Representative, but I jumped in with. I just wanted to make sure that, in terms of the representation that I made to the folks at GM, that I didn't expect them to come in and have sales data and RSIs and DPS data for every single individual dealer in Minnesota. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Mr. Perry, just very briefly, I know it was in the news yesterday that GM's paying back their bailout funds, yet they have their own 61% by the federal government through stock, giving the federal government stock in GM. Is there any plan at GM to recoup that stock to get off the government dole? Because I had to do something very extreme. I'm a GM guy, or I was a GM guy. I went out last week and bought a Ford F-150 Lariat. And
what?
Yeah, I did. Have you driven a Ford lately?
Yes, I have.
So it's very disconcerting to me, because where I'm from, we've got a one dealer left who's a very good dealer, and I just can't buy GM or Chrysler right now, because owned that much by the government, it's doomed to fail. If 61% ownership by the federal government, it's not going anywhere. So the question is, does GM, or are they working on a plan to purchase back the stock to get off the government dole so Greg Davis can buy another Suburban? That's the question.
Yeah, Mr. Perry, I would actually, to answer that question, I would say that's even further beyond my pay grade, as they say. I know Mr. Whitaker has spoken about the initial public offerings recently, and I believe as recently as maybe a day or two ago. There were some announcements made as to when we anticipate being able to pay back some of the primary loans, which I think the latest article I read said June of next year. And then the remaining stock that you're referring to is going to be subject to part of the IPO. When that IPO is going to take place, I wouldn't have the slightest ability to answer that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davis.
Invite Mr. Whitaker next time.
We should. Actually, I've heard him. He seems like a fairly eloquent guy. We're not averse to doing that. And they've come. I've got Representative Anderson with a question, then Representative Abler and Zeller. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You asked the question that I had. And perhaps, though you kind of drew the short straw, it sounds like, in coming here today, if you can maybe take back some of these questions and get the answers to them. Because I am particularly interested in the point that you raised, Representative Atkins, or Chair Atkins, I should say. But then also I had the question about, you had mentioned that you kept in the loop the facilities that had the dealerships that had modernized their facilities. And I know of a couple of examples of dealerships that were closed that had just dumped in a whole lot of money in renovating their facilities. And so it's not jiving with me when you say that they chose to close down facilities that weren't considered modernized. So if you can get an answer for that as well, I think it would help kind of clear this up, because it's just, the dots aren't connecting for me.
Sure. Now, in response to that that comment, maybe be helpful to point out, as Ms. Shalander had summarized with the federal legislation, that, and we do fully expect President Obama to sign that at some point in the very near future. One of the first requirements of that is that within 30 days of its enactment, we would be required to send each and every dealer that received wind down notification the details of their specific scenario. So it would be inclusive of their performance numbers and how those performance numbers netted out, what the specific decisions were made based on. And I think some of that will get to the point that you're making.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. And no offense, Representative Abler, I take members of the committee first.
That's fine.
And then, what a fine minority leader you are, deferring to. All right. So we'll go A to Z then. Representative Abler.
We already had the election. Anyway, well, thanks. And I just, as a shareholder, I should maybe ask a question, since I guess I own part of this thing. It's too bad they sent you without anything you could tell us, and you're not allowed to talk. You get a big company, which is America, and then it becomes people who do things that are unreasonable, and then no one's allowed to know anything, and it's just unfortunate. I'm sad about that. The Anoka franchise is one to know most about. It's on the freeway. It's in a stable part of town. It's got mammoth frontage. It's been around for 90 years. None of the things you talked about even hit that. And so we, I'm not in the Commerce Committee, I'm in the Health World, but it's just as silly there how we do business sometimes. If the decision is made that makes sense to people, just looking at like, oh, that's a reasonable decision, then no one minds. You don't get legislation at the federal level to undo what somebody decided. You don't get hearings where people are outraged about why would you do that to Rochester or Anoka or whatever. But when you do that kind of stuff, then no one trusts you. And this guy, I love GMC, at least he did. I drive a GMC truck, which I like a lot. I'm nervous by another one, frankly. So I don't know if they're going to be any good, but... and I know if they're, it's just that we don't know. And then when a leadership does decisions like this, you lose all confidence. And you fulfill the prophecy that it's going to go bad. And GM needs to win for America. It needs to, the jobs need to be there. Anoka needs 80 jobs. Rochester needs the jobs. And we need a strong bunch of American car makers. And so I tell you this only if you can go back and tell the people you work for, would you be normal? Would you just treat people with the respect that you wish that they would treat you with? That when they, you know, and then no laws happen. And you can govern well, you can make decisions, and negotiations go better. And so I hope in the appeal process that they prove whoever decided that an Oakland dealership should be closed stays open. And I hope the Rochester deal survives. And some will have to go because they maybe had too many out on that part. But so just take the message back. I didn't mean to do it. That was just information to you, no personal attack.
Well,
but thank you.
One thing to take great solace in, though, is that relative to the original proposal that was made for a non-legislative solution, which was not much of an original proposal, it said if we abided by our own criteria, then the arbitrator would have to side with us. The new language actually takes into account all of the factors that you alluded to. You specifically used Maine Motors, but we could look across. We've got a number of folks sitting here with us from Lake Elmo and elsewhere across the state. That sat here with us a month ago and have shared specifics about how they meet many of the criteria that have been laid out in the federal legislation. So if, in fact, President Obama signs that, I think we can at least take some degree of solace in the fact that there will be a neutral arbitrator that will actually take those factors into account. and that's at least a very positive sign. I'm just glad that Congress acted on it before our hearing like they were supposed to. Representative Zeller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Perry, I don't know what you did back at the office, but you're going to have a Merry Christmas because you'll be blessed for turning up with this. But as the, you work for the company, the guy that's here, we're going to have to give you our thoughts and opinions. And the thing that I wanted to focus on are these wind down payment or payments that they're going to come out. I think you said that was one area where you didn't know a little bit about. And as we've been listening to this process, I kind of smell something coming, and this whole deal smells. I just want to tell you from the beginning, I think this is all a horrible idea, but going forward, the wind down payments that are going to come out before the reauthorization or the refranchising, or as the chair said, so you get the chance to buy back your business that's already yours and you've been building for, in this case, 90 years, are the wind down payments going to be pretty close ballpark to what it's going to cost these owners to buy back their business? Do you get what I'm saying? They're going to get a payment that's equal to their buyout, the $1 million, and to buy back in, it's $1.2 million or something like that. Is this the shell game that we're going to play, or are these folks just going to be able to keep their businesses outright and not have to go through this junk?
That's fair. I guess the answer to that question is, as far as I could answer, the two are completely unrelated. The dealers have funds that they have to put forth in order to buy their buildings, to buy some inventory, startup costs in a business. There are no franchise costs to General Motors. We don't get a dime from a dealer personally to say, we're giving you a franchise, now give us a check for the franchise as an intangible item. There's no such transfer. Now, I'm not saying the dealers don't have startup costs, and I'm not saying they're not sizable. I don't have a way to compare the two. And every dealer's payout under this compensation for the wind-down agreement would have been different. They were based on specific criteria. For example, one of the criteria would have been the inventory. And again, I don't know exactly how that calculation worked out, if it was per car. I've just been given some very general generalities around it myself. But part of the payment was calculated based on their inventory. They were given so much per car, for example. And then another part of it was based on some rent, a rent factor. So each dealer's payout amount for the wind down would have been different.
Representative Zeller?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The process just as it was going forward, and I don't know, and since you're not going to answer some of the specific questions, I challenge you, Mrs. Carlson laid it out pretty crystal clear for us. Representative Abel are talking about what kind of community citizens they've been, business partners with the city. If nothing else, we'll forward you an email with a tape of this. Play for whoever gets to make this decision. Play that tape, because I don't know how honestly anybody, after watching what Mr. and Mrs. Carlson presented to you, could go ahead and take away their business like that. If they're not going to listen to you then, the chairman's done a good job of doing some pretty forceful things with business owners in the state. Maybe we're going to have to do the same thing here in the state of Minnesota to defend our business owners, because this is a sham and should never, ever happen.
We've got, and just the kind of the landscape for where we're at this afternoon, as you folks know, we've got a second hearing that begins at 2:30. I want to, Representative Hoppe has one final question. I believe we'll take that. And then we're going to break for just a couple minutes while we then get reconvened as a joint committee with the Health and Human Services Finance Division to take up our next topic. But I'd invite you to continue visiting. We've got a number of dealers, and we've got Mr. Perry here. We probably won't get underway till 2:35, 2:40, so there's little chance to have some follow-up individually with those folks, and I'd ask you to do that. The other thing that I would point out is that I would expect our conversation with General Motors to continue. Whatever I receive back, whatever we send on behalf of the committee, obviously we will share with all members of the committee as well as with Representative Averler and those other state. I see Representative Bunn on behalf of Lake Elmo, who's got a dealership there that's impacted. But we'll make sure that we share that information, because on a bipartisan basis, Mr. Perry, you've probably figured out that we feel very strongly about what's happening to these dealers and all those families 3,000 plus families in Minnesota that are being impacted by that decision. Representative Hoppe, our new lead on the Republican side, you get last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Perry, I'll give you a couple of questions just to, you know, think about or bring back that I don't expect answers to right now, and maybe you don't have them. For the Carlsons and other people that are looking at trying to buy back their dealership, what happens to their employees? I mean, do their employees just wait to see if they have a job, if they're going to have a job there? If not, do they go find another job? What happens to customers? Do they go in for warranty work there? Do they go get service work done somewhere else? Do they start building new relationships? And then I'll leave you with those and some other questions. But one quick question that hopefully you'll know the answer to, maybe there isn't an answer yet. For the going forward dealerships and for the rest of us, for the state of Minnesota, are there more closings coming? I mean, how do we know that the dealerships that we're left with right now aren't going to go through this again 6 or 8 months from now?
Good question. Mr. Perry?
I can't give you exact... I will take questions all back. Thank you very much. On the last question, I wish I could answer that for you. I have not myself heard of any additional wind-downs that are expected from any of this, the list as it exists. And to be perfectly frank, I haven't seen a list, and we haven't made anything public to anybody. The dealers themselves, if they were identified as a wind-down dealer, it is entirely up to them if they want to let people know that they were selected for that. There are many dealers today that haven't said anything, that they're part of that process. And we don't plan to publish that list. It's a private matter, and it's the dealer's right to make that decision as they see fit. But as I said, going forward, I'm not aware of anything that would indicate we're planning to add additional dealers to this list for this whole process at this point. Now, you know, going forward into infinitum, there will be dealer closing as happens with normal business. So.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Perry. Thank you to the folks that testified with us. Thank you to the folks that joined us here today. Frankly, thank you to Congress and for working out a compromise that actually takes into account legitimate criteria that will go before arbitrators. We'll continue the conversation as we move forward with that. We'll take a 10-minute recess, come back with our next topic with the Health and Human Services Finance Division. We stand in recess. Folks, we'll come back from recess. Thank you to the members of the Health and Human Services Finance Division for joining us. We, on behalf of Representative Huntley and myself, we not only do we appreciate you being here, but we particularly appreciate you being here during the interim. We know that folks who have real lives and sort of hold an interim hearing, we know is, other than Chairman Huntley, he doesn't have really a real life. I think he's here almost all the time. But we certainly appreciate your efforts here this afternoon. This is obviously an important topic to talk about the possible sale of health insurance across state lines here in Minnesota. We thought it might benefit members of both committees to try to get us on the same page at the outset. So we kindly refer to Tom Pender as Professor Pender in our committee. He's great at sort of providing a 30,000-foot overview of to get us all to the same point or launching off spot from which we can then proceed to have a good discussion. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Pender to give us an overview of the issue. We then, what I anticipate is to take all of the testimony first, and once we've gone through the folks that desire to testify, then go back, circle back around and take questions and concerns that members may have. So again, thank you for being here, and with that I'll turn it over to Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chairs and members, I'm Tom Pender from the House Research Department. I was asked to give a 10-minute overview of the pending federal health care reform legislation as it applies to the issue of sales of health insurance across state lines. I provided a handout. It's a four-page handout that says at the top, health insurance sales across state lines, what do the current federal health reform bills provide. It's almost four pages, and I'm not going to be able to cover a lot of it in 10 minutes, so I'm going to be kind of skipping through it, hitting the high points. First, what is this issue of sales of health insurance across state lines? The two health care reform bills currently being considered by Congress both deal with this issue. It hasn't been getting as much attention in the media as certain other issues. It involves basically whether to permit insurance companies to sell health insurance in a state when the coverage they're selling doesn't comply with that state's laws, as long as it does comply with some other state's laws or with an interstate agreement. And the types of differences in state laws that are involved in this kind of proposal, in other words, the things that would be required under the consumer's state laws that would not be covered by these policies, are typically what are called mandated benefits, things that are required by state law to be covered. All states have quite a few of these, including Minnesota, and it's things like cancer screening, coverage of diabetic supplies, coverage of chemical dependency treatment, and a whole variety of different things where the mandates vary from one state to another. Under current law, health insurance is sold and regulated on a state-by-state basis, and in order to sell health insurance coverage in a state, the insurer has to be licensed in that state, and the products that it sells have to be products that are permitted under the laws of that state, that meet the law's requirements. As kind of background for the federal bill, I'll just mention briefly that in 2006, Minnesota entered into an interstate compact to deal with sales of insurance across state lines. And there are over 30 states in that compact now, and they're working on standards that would be acceptable for the sale of insurance in all of those states. But the subject matter of the compact doesn't include health insurance. It includes life insurance, annuities, disability income, and long-term care insurance. So it's a similar kind of endeavor, but it's, I think they probably decided to not deal with health insurance because it's too controversial and too complicated. What I'm going to do here is go through quickly the House and Senate versions of health care reform and how they deal with this issue. And each of these bills is about 2,000 pages total, and this is just a small piece of those bills. And in case you haven't been following this really closely, the House version has passed the House, and the Senate is now debating its version on the Senate floor, and it's being changed to some extent daily, either on the Senate floor or in behind closed doors meetings. First, with the House bill, how it deals with sales of insurance across state lines. It uses the same concept I just mentioned that's been used for other kinds of insurance. It uses the concept of interstate insurance compacts, and it permits two or more states to form what it calls a healthcare choice compact to make it possible to purchase, and this is just the individual market, not group market, allow purchase of individual health insurance across state lines beginning in 2015. And so basically it just says two or more states can form a compact. So this could involve many states, many different compacts, could involve just one. Theoretically, I suppose states could be in more than one of these compacts. And the federal government's required to come up with model guidelines for these. And the first one I thought was kind of interesting. I'm now at the top of page 2 of my handout if you're following along. The compact has to specify that one of the states in the compact is the, quote, primary state, and the others in the compact are the secondary states. And basically the deal in the compact then is that the secondary states would agree that insurance could be sold in their states as long as it complies with the laws of the primary state, even though it doesn't comply with the laws of the secondary state. It's kind of hard to imagine a group of states getting together and, you know, agreeing that one of them is going to have this privilege of being the primary state, and that the insurance companies can, to some extent, just ignore the laws of the secondary states if they choose to do so, and if the compact allows it.
This law requires that would require that all health insurers selling health insurance coverage in a secondary state be licensed in that state. And this is something that kind of drew my attention, because if we look at Minnesota, we have a Minnesota unique situation in this state where we don't allow for-profit HMOs to be licensed in this state. We require that they be non-profit. And so my question as I was looking at this is, well, would this requirement that health insurers be licensed in the secondary states mean if we're a secondary state that the for-profit HMOs would not be allowed to participate because they wouldn't be allowed to be licensed? And as far as I could tell, and there, you know, each of these bills is 2,000 pages, but as far as I could tell, that issue is not addressed in the bill. The compact would have to preserve the authority of the state to deal with consumer protection, which is not defined in the bill, and other related kinds of things, unfair trade practices and so on. I list them here in paragraph 4. And so the states where the consumer lives would govern those things, and basically what's covered by the policy would be governed by, in this case, the laws of the primary state. The laws would require that a clear and conspicuous disclosure to consumers that the policy may not be subject to all of the laws of the consumer's state. The federal law, this House version, specifies that no state's required to join a compact, and in fact that a state can enter into a compact like this only if the state enacts legislation agreeing to enter the compact. And that's what we did in Minnesota in 2006 when we entered the existing compact that doesn't cover health insurance. Also, the federal law requires that states retain responsibility for enforcement regarding their own consumers. So Minnesota consumers, for instance, would be able to access Minnesota courts to resolve a dispute, or have the Minnesota Commissioner of Commerce try to resolve a dispute with the company if it's an issue of whether the company can do what it's doing. Another thing that's in the House bill is that provides grants for states that enter compacts to cover their administration costs, or at least to pay something toward their administration costs. And there's a sort of a vague formula set forth in the law for to decide how much states would get. As far as I can see, all of this could be done voluntarily by the states, and they could enter into compacts just like we did in these other areas of insurance, could be done voluntarily by the states now without the federal law. But I guess the answer is that the states haven't chosen to do this for health insurance, so maybe this will be a prime. Moving on to the Senate bill, this is the one that's still on the Senate floor and still fluid, as we say, has a sort of a similar provision on setting up the possibility of states entering into the health care choice compact. They don't have this concept of the primary, secondary states and so on. It's just basically that states can get together and agree basically on which mandated benefits they're going to cover or not cover. And the federal approach is similar in some ways. It's a little more regulatory. For one thing, it requires that the Health and Human Services approve each compact, which is not in the in the House bill, and sets forth some criteria. This is kind of in the middle of page 3 here. And interestingly, one of them is that the compact must not increase the federal deficit. The compacts can't go into effect until 2016, which is a year later than the House version, and the Senate doesn't provide any grants for the states to grease the skids on the cost of doing this. The Senate also adds an additional thing calling for or permitting what it calls nationwide health plans. And I'm not going to go into detail on this, partly because it's a Senate-only provision and the Senate bill isn't off the floor yet. But basically, it would allow, under certain circumstances, insurer to sell a health plan nationwide without there being a compact. And this would be subject to have to comply with federal regulations on what the health plan could do and could not do. Both of these bills have language, very specific language, making it clear that the kind of mandates that these laws would allow insurers not to cover are not the kind of mandates that deal with providers. So they want to make it very clear that they're not messing with state laws that say that insurers have to pay certain types of providers, chiropractors or optometrists, for instance, for care that is within their scope of practice and can't discriminate against providers. And also they make it clear that they're not messing with what we call covered persons mandates, or what kinds of people have to be covered as dependents. For instance, how long you can keep a young adult on coverage, whether they're a full-time student or not, and so on. I also just want to add here, in conclusion, that there's another whole part of this bill, the health insurance exchange part of the bill, that would create health insurance exchanges. In the House bill, it would be one national health insurance exchange, and in the Senate, it would be a state-by-state kind of situation. But depending upon the details, those exchanges have some possibility for allowing sales of health insurance across state lines also if they meet certain requirements. So anyway, that's a really brief overview of what these bills do as far as selling insurance across state lines, and we won't know the results until the Senate bill gets passed and gets to conference committee and something gets enacted if it does. So we'll just have to stay tuned.
Thank you, Mr. Pender. Up next on our agenda, we have Manny Munson-Regala from who's the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Governor Plenty has indicated that he has a different approach than what has been proposed federally. And we have Commissioner Wilson from the Department of Commerce as well. Hopefully, Ms. Munson-Regala and Commissioner Wilson will be able to point out the distinctions of what the governor's proposal is relative to what's being proposed at the federal level. Ms. Munson-Regala and Commissioner Wilson, whoever wants to kick it off, please feel free.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman Atkins and Chairman Huntley, members of the committee, for the opportunity. This is a complex project that's been handed to us, and so we are in the middle of studying how some of these may affect the state and what maybe some of the state's alternatives really are. So with that, when the governor asked us to take a look at what some of them are, we've put together some comments. But first of all, there were four things that we wanted to make sure that were covered in anything that we were interested in. First of all, competition and consumer protection were number one. It had to remain at the state level. That was paramount. Consumer protection clearly, and consumer choice as well, so that it wasn't one for all. The other thing is that the state had to have some input into the program. Last, there were two approaches that came up. As Mr. Pender did a very good job of outlining, I think, some of those choices, but the unilateral option where we would open up our borders for other state products, and the compact. So those were some of the areas that we looked at. The federal law allows the purchase of insurance plans across state lines, so that was a focus. And the new federal proposal would further preempt the state regulations and insurance market. We wanted to protect best we could there. Sorry we don't have handouts, but before many months of delegates started, I did want to say that we are going to post our comments on our website later today, so that they'll be available tomorrow to anybody that wants to look at them.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Mr. Munson-Regella, the only thing I'd ask as you go through, I think if we look up to the sides, we can probably make out what's being said, but is perhaps you can try to the extent the type is small, for those that may have difficulty seeing it, that you try to give an indication of what it says. But the second request that I would make of you is, to the extent that that something is specific to what the governor is proposing compared to what is being proposed at the federal level, that you separate that out as this is coming from the administration or from the governor. All right? Mr. Munson-Regella.
Thank you, Chairman. We will also send a copy of our presentation to Mr. Reich, and he'll be able to pass it on to the members of the committee, so they'll have it.
Thank you.
This slide gives you a sense of the environment in which we're playing. It talks about where Minnesotans get their care from: fully insured plans, private self-insured plans, Medicare, MAD, and GMAC, Medicare, MCHA, and the uninsured population. It's the change from 1993 to 2007. The key metric here is the pie that says fully insured plans. That's the space of the world that we get to play with and get to deal with and get to regulate. That pie continues to shrink, and it's been a relatively consistent trend. Our concern is that a number of provisions in the federal reform proposals will further erode the share of the marketplace that are subject to the rules and regulations that we administer. Mr. Pender's covered some of this. I'll quickly breeze through this. He's talked about the exchange. He's talked about the fact that the benefit plans will be created in the House bill under the Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services with the benefit of a Health Benefits Advisory Committee. One item you might want to be cognizant about is that states can maintain their own benefit mandates, but in the event that the benefit mandates impose an additional cost beyond the subsidies that are going to be provided for subsidized policies in the exchange, the state will be responsible for paying that difference. It's not entirely clear how they're going to come up with that calculation or what the mechanism will be for collecting that difference, but that is one of the elements of the House bill. The House continues in compact. Mr. Pender's talked about that. Again, he is correct. The states would have to identify one state to be the lead dog, and that state standard would trump. And would, other than for respect to market conduct, unfair trade practices, network accuracy, and other, as Mr. Pender points out, undefined consumer protection standards. We talked about this also on the Senate side. There, the exchanges will be either regional or state-based. The benefits will be based on benefits defined by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Like the House approach, if there's a difference in the cost of the products that the state requires from their benefit mandate, the state pays the difference. Now, we've talked, Mr. Pender talked about the compact proposal. The only thing we would add to his short synopsis, it's likely a drafting error, we suspect, but if you read the Senate language as currently drafted, there's no limitation that the insurer has to pick a compacting member standard to control. I suspect that probably was an oversight. But under the Senate approach, the insurer gets to pick which of the state standards in the compact they use for the purposes of determining the parameters of their plan. Some quick information about national qualified health plans, subsidy spans with the states in which the plan was originally issued or written. The state's plans have to meet the minimum criteria that contained in the definition of the essential benefits package. Again, that's a package that the Secretary of Health and Human Services will define. It's sold individual and small groups. Mr. Pender indicated states can opt out of the national marketplace. By legislation, you can choose to decide that no national plan can be sold in Minnesota. Now, you asked about
to provide, what's my apologies for the professor. One of the other national plans approach that we thought would be important to share with you was a proposal under Chairman Bacchus's original draft to create a national plan that would have a benefit design essentially driven by mandates found in the majority of the states. So we took a look at the mandates that Minnesota required to find out which of those mandates would be contained in the majority of the states and which ones would not. This is a list of the mandates that would be contained in the state. Newborn, breast reconstruction, mammography, maternity minimum stay, in all of the states. Diabetic supplies, emergency service, mental health parity, 47 in the states. We'll get down to nurse midwife, 28, social worker, 27. The next slide shows you which ones are not found in the majority of states. Maternity, only found in 23. Mastectomy, only found in 23. Osteopath, 23. Mr. Fender noted that perhaps some of the providers may not be within this definition. We're looking at that. I'm not sure we entirely concur, but be as it may, these are the ones that would fall in that category. Port wine stain, we're one of two. Sex drop drugs, we're one of three. Reconstructive surgery, we're one of two. The other proposal that's floating out there that might have an impact on our state is a proposal to have the Office of Personal Management create a national plan that any uninsured can purchase. That national plan would be based upon the current plans being offered to federal employees. Not knowing the details, because we understand that's a concept, we haven't seen language, we took a stab at identifying what mandates are not covered under existing federal plans sold to Minnesota employees. These are the coverages that are not included in Minnesota under the federal employee plan. PMJ is not covered. Hearing aids, testing and damage from minors, not covered. Mental health parity, they don't have language relative to that. Nutritional dietary substances, PKU. Private duty nursing. Public facilities. Care prosthesis. What we did is we took a national, you can go to the Office of Personal Management. They have their plans for Minnesota listed. We pulled, I believe, the Aetna plan to do a comparison to see how it differed from what we would require had they had to file in Minnesota. So with that as sort of background, by way of contrast, to get to your point, Chairman Atkins, this is what the governor is proposing with respect to creating competition and an alternative to Minnesota. The first is, as the commissioner noted, a unilateral approach that would allow Minnesota to allow companies to sell a product approved in another state in Minnesota. But let me explain in detail what that plan proposal makes. First, it's intended to give consumers and companies more flexibility and choices. They have to be admitted companies. Why is that important? No company gets into our state without passing our test relative to solvency. Do they have the money to pay the claim? That's number one. Two, do they have the requisite business plan? I don't want to use the word moral character. That can be an odd term to apply to companies. But we do a fair amount of looking at the folks who run those companies to determine whether or not there's anything in their background that gives us pause as to whether or not they are admitted to our state. Which is my way of saying that my company folks make it abundantly clear there are some companies that will never get to do business in our state because they have enough of a track record in other states that gives us pause that they'd be a good participant in our marketplace. Secondly, the product has to be approved by states that meet defined levels of consumer protection, competition, and acceptable healthcare outcomes. Now, what does that mean in sort of detail? We're working with the governor's office on the criteria to identify those states. The thought is to articulate a set of criteria that will help identify gold standard states or whatever label you want to use that we believe have an acceptable regulatory regime or outcome consumer marketplace that would be give us belief that their products should be sold here. In response to some concerns that the structure we set up puts our domestic insurers at some disadvantage, the proposal we provide to the governor, and again the governor's office is working on legislation relative to this proposal, will ensure that there is a level playing field. For example, these folks would have to be subject to our fees and assessments. These folks would likely have to be subject to our reporting requirements. They would have to be subject to certainly our market conduct and consumer protection law. So my staff, the staff that does enforcement and consumer complaints, would be the ones responsible for handling those claims on those policies. There's language relative to disclosure, identifying how this plan differs from the Minnesota standards. We also propose to the governor that our criteria for identifying what states get allowed, what states make the cutoff, get promulgated by our rulemaking. So we'll have the opportunity to get input from interested parties, consumers, domestic industry, providers, as we promulgate the criteria for determining what states meet our cutoff. Lastly, we would note that in terms of for proof of concept as to how competition may impact the marketplace, the legislature was kind enough a few years ago to pass the Minnesota Flexible Benefits Health Insurance Law, allowing some degree of flexibility in the small group market. We haven't had a lot of filings relative to use of that law, but we can say that where we have had filings made, the policies being sold are being marketed, depending on which network you choose, somewhere in the range of 8 to 11% less than their full plan. The commissioner has indicated the governor also has a proposal that he calls a multilateral approach, and that is the Interstate Health Insurance Compact. It's modeled on the current Interstate Insurance Product Regulatory Commission. These are the states that are members of the compact. We're up to 36 states right now, and we continue to work with other states to get them involved in the compact. Mr. Fender talked a little bit about the compact. I would add one change to his presentation. He noted, I think in his written materials, the compact has not promulgated any standards. They have, in fact, promulgated a number of standards, and a number of companies have made filings and have had them approved by the Interstate Compact. What does the current compact model look like? 36 states with a shared governance structure. What does the shared governance structure mean? There are three tiers in the management committee of the Interstate Compact. They're based on size and population of premiums, large states, medium states, small states. All states rotate through the leadership structure in their tier, which means, for example, when we first joined the compact, when Minnesota joined the compact, we were part of the executive management committee. In fact, the commissioner was the secretary treasurer for some time period on the compact. When Wisconsin joined, we rotated off because they were the newest mid-sized state. But now that Virginia has moved off, we're back on the management structure. So all of the members of the compact get an opportunity to be part of the management team at some time in their life cycle. The compact is also a voluntary process. There is an opt-out procedure for any state to opt out on any single standard. In fact, we recently underwent a process where Missouri provided notice that they planned on opting out of a specific standard relative to, I believe, disability. They worked through the process. They had their regulatory concerns addressed, and then they chose to opt out of their opt-out. In other words, they decided not to proceed with the mechanical steps of continuing the process of opting out. Now, you may ask, why is there such a degree of uniformity and consensus at the compact? Well, the whole purpose of the compact is to come up with a best practices uniform of national standards on the product it regulates, life insurance, annuities, disability, and long-term care. In order to get that degree of uniformity that reflects the consensus and best practices of the debate, let me just put these up here real quick. The compacts have a structure that formally gets input from consumers, from industry, and from legislators. There are advisory committees representing the viewpoints of those entities. They provide input to the Product Standards Committee. The Product Standards Committee then provides recommendations to the Executive Committee. The Executive Committee then provides recommendations to the full board, and the board then acts to implement those standards. For those who've worked with my staff, you can share my joy and understanding that they have some fairly strong perspectives on what makes sense in the insurance regulatory area. They've had a strong hand in the development of those standards. I think we can confirm to you that in many cases, the standards are exactly the same standards we apply in Minnesota, number one. Number two, get to the same place in a different way than we would have done it, but we're comfortable with that approach. Or alternatively, and this may surprise some of you, craft a standard stronger than the existing standard we have in Minnesota. So our sense has been of the process of the standard promulgation discussion that rather than a race to the bottom, which was some of the concern of the skeptics of joining contacts in the first place, has been that rather the standards have moved towards the strongest regulatory standards for a couple of different reasons. Part of it is we really strive to get unanimity and consensus. So if any one state has a standard that's particularly important to them, the Product Standards Committee tries to figure out a way to accommodate that state's concerns. Some other points about the compact that might be relevant for you. For companies, why would companies use this? They get to file one product one place and suddenly get access to 30 different markets rather than going through a state-by-state filing process. The average turnaround time is 24 days. Comparable to the time in our state, we like to take pride in our speed to market too, but it's a fairly good process. The standards, the product reviewers, are folks with combined expertise, average expertise, 25 plus years. In many cases, they're former insurance regulators from other departments. Lastly, the state continues their role as market regulator. All the compact does, and I need to stress this, all the compact does is review the product, the sale of that product, the handling of the claims, the types of concerns that consumers would have still fall to the state. And for the most part, the rates associated with those products still fall to the state. There's some conversation right now whether or not rating structures relative to long-term care should be an interstate compact standard, but that conversation has not been resolved. Now, the commission is going to talk a little bit about the reaction to the governor's proposal on creating an interstate health insurance compact.
Commissioner Wilson. Thank you, Chair and members. Just very briefly, the governor did send a letter out outlining the two options that he was interested in pursuing and those that he had asked us to be engaged in and study on his behalf. We did that. We followed up then with a letter to the commissioners inviting them to a meeting which was held in San Francisco at the NAIC meeting last Sunday at 8 a.m. Considering that we weren't part of the agenda, or the formal program of the NAIC. We did have 15 commissioners attend the meeting. About 22 states were present. We went through some of the options, and I have to confirm Manny's comments that as far as we're concerned in our department, the experience that we had in the development of the compact took about 2 years, and then as an officer of the compact for 2 years and getting it started, it's been slow, and as Mr. Pender pointed out, this is not going to be an easy process. It's particularly on Medicare, it's more complex. as he indicated it may be. Clearly it is. But I do, given the history that we have in the development of the compact on life and annuities and long-term care, it's been good. Manny pointed out the fact that we've raised the bar in many states. The other thing that we've noticed in the department that makes it relevant, that as we would like to, I believe, in 7 years in this job, that it is important to maintain the consumer contact at this level. I don't see a federal model that would provide the same level of contact and provision for consumers. And so when I look at it, the compact does provide that. But at the same time, for the populations that we have that's very mobile, either the people that are providing some of the care or the consumers are quite mobile, this would help standardize those products on an interstate basis. I think the compact that we have is going to continue to grow. I think this is a particularly good option, and we're going to continue to study it best we can and continue to report back to these two committees. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Funston-Regala. The up next on our agenda, and I suspect we'll come back with questions for you gentlemen, but I just want to make sure that we hear from the folks that have asked to testify before us. Next up is Ms. Sonier from the Minnesota Department of Health. And just to kind of give a sense of the pathway from here to the end of this hearing, Chair Huntley and I discussed, obviously there's no action being taken here. The goal here is to sort of provide a introduction to the topic, both what's happening nationally to the extent that we can do so in a reasonable period of time, but also Governor Valenti's thoughts and ideas with respect to it. Our hope was to be able to conclude within about an hour and a half of when we started, which aim at about 4:15-ish, try to get people out of here so that they can beat traffic. But keep in mind that this won't be the final word. We're obviously not taking any action today, but if any proposals move forward relative to the sale of across state lines of health insurance, it'll be coming before both committees for actual formal action. So with that, Ms. Sonier, and by the way, we apologize. I know that you've got other obligations that you have to get to as well, and we're running a little bit behind, but appreciate your patience with us.
Sure, no problem. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Sonier, and I'm Director of the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. I do have a PowerPoint presentation, but while that's coming up, I will just start with the introductory pieces, and I understand if you have handouts so that we can maybe follow along. That's for the early slides. I've been asked by the committee today to come and talk about the impact that mandated health insurance benefits have on insurance premiums, and my presentation will be brief. Mandated benefits, there are several different types of mandates, but generally speaking, they are requirements that are placed on private health insurance coverage either by state or federal government. There are several different types of mandates, so one of the most commonly what most people mean when they talk about mandated benefits is mandates that require health insurance plans to cover specific kinds of services. And so examples of that would be immunizations or cancer screening. Sometimes the term is used a little bit more broadly to describe mandates to cover services when they're received from certain kinds of providers. So for example, a nurse practitioner or when services are received from a chiropractor. Another kind of mandate relates to populations that must be covered. So an example there would be that health plans are required to cover newborns from the moment that they're born, or requirements about coverage for adopted children. And then finally, there are mandates that relate to market rules, so rules for the issuance and termination of coverage or regulation of premiums. One important distinction between mandates enforced by the state and federal governments is that the state mandates only apply to fully insured health plans. And in Minnesota, this is about 40% of the people who have private health insurance. Looking now at the chart on slide 3 in your handout, and it's a pie chart that describes Minnesota's population by their primary source of insurance coverage, and this is in 2007, and this is data from our program. It's the same data that was used in the Commerce Department slides, but really, the point is very similar, to show that the reach of state government mandates really is only about one quarter of our state's population. Importantly, about two-thirds of Minnesotans have private insurance, mainly through an employer. Within this segment of the population that has private insurance, less than half, or if that translates to 27% of the total population, have coverage in the fully insured market, and that's the portion of the market that the state regulates. In thinking about the impact that mandates have on health insurance premiums, there are a couple of important things to think about. One of those is the size of the impact is going to depend on the cost of services per person affected by the mandate. So something that is a relatively inexpensive service, like immunization, is going to have a small per-person cost, but there's a very large population affected by that. Conversely, there are some mandates that are very, very expensive but affect only a small number of people. It's important to distinguish between the percentage of the total premium that pays for services that are covered by mandates as a distinct concept from what would happen to health insurance premiums if mandates were repealed. And the difference here is that many of these services would likely still be covered even in the absence of a mandate. And some of the evidence for that is that many self-insured employers voluntarily cover services that are otherwise mandated by state law. So maternity benefits is a very good example of that. It seems unlikely that employers would be suddenly dropping maternity benefits if that mandate were repealed. I want to talk a little bit about a state-specific study that we had done back in 2005. That was done for the State Health Department by Mercer Government Human Services Consulting. And what they did was they took a comprehensive list of benefit mandates in Minnesota that was compiled by us and estimated both what the impact is in terms of total premiums and what the marginal impact is. And that's what the impact if the mandates were repealed, how much would premiums go down by. They estimated the impact separately for the large group market, the small group market, and individual markets. We think it's likely that the market response to the removal of mandates would likely vary. I think we're pretty much caught up now on the slide, which is great. I'm just getting to the part where it's important to have something to look at. This table that sits up on the screen now summarizes the study results for the private health insurance market as a whole. So in total, mandated benefits in Minnesota were estimated to account for about 12.7% of premiums, and mandates related to maternity and well child care represented almost half of this total. The cost of services related to mental health and chemical dependency was nearly 5% of premium, and the remaining 20 other mandates combined that we counted were about 2% of premium. Overall, however, the study results show that the marginal impact of these mandates on premiums was only 1.3%. Mental health and chemical dependency accounted for most of this, or 0.9% of premium, meaning that coverage for these services would be the most likely to be dropped if mandates were repealed. Looking at the different segments of the private market separately, the largest marginal impact of mandated benefits is in the small group market, where premiums and covered benefits were estimated to be about 4.3% higher than they would be in the absence of mandates. The marginal impact in the individual market was estimated at 1% and 0.8% in the large group market. Although there aren't very many similar studies that we have to compare to, the findings from this Minnesota-specific analysis are consistent with other recent research that we're aware of. For example, the Congressional Budget Office has recently estimated that state benefit mandates increase premiums in the individual small group markets by about 2 to 3%, and a study performed for the Maryland Healthcare Commission found that mandates accounted for 15 to 18% of total premium. The marginal impact was about 2%, meaning that if they were repealed, premiums would go down by about 2% on average. Findings were similar to ours, that the most expensive mandates are for mental health and maternity services. And they also had a specific, were able to do some specific analysis around self-funded plans and found that they voluntarily covered about 86% of the cost of state mandated services. So what that means is it supports the conclusion that the marginal impact of mandates is relatively small, even though they, as a share of total premiums, the services that are paid for may be rather large. So just to quickly summarize my testimony, we do know that benefit mandates do increase premium costs. In general, the marginal impact for the set of mandates that we have in current Minnesota law is not large. The most expensive mandates that we have are related to maternity and mental health. It's important probably also to note that both of these areas are also subject to some federal mandates. There is a new federal mandate related to mental health parity that will go into effect in 2010. And finally, the evidence that we have about the premium cost of benefit mandates in Minnesota is consistent with other research findings. So that concludes my testimony. I do need to leave very shortly, but I do have time for some questions if you have them.
Well, and I appreciate the fact we've got your contact information as the final slide. And I apologize. We knew you needed to be out of here by 3:15, but we appreciate very much you're willing to stick around. And what I'd suggest is that we take that opportunity. We've got, I guess, your phone number, too. But the phone number and email for follow-up questions that people may have. So thank you very much for joining us. The next on the list, I have Ms. Kimball from AARP. And just for committee members, we've got Ms. Kimball, we've got Ms. Aberholden from NAMI of Minnesota, Ms. Perriott from who's the Vice President of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Midwest Division, and then finally Mr. Griffin. So four testifiers. And then an opportunity for some questions. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I am Michelle Kimball. I'm a senior state director for AARP in Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today about the interstate purchasing of health insurance and the potential consequences for Minnesota consumers. As you may know, AARP represents about 700,000 Minnesotans between the ages of 50 and 64 here in Minnesota, and nearly 40 million nationwide. And while many of our members, I represent more than 700,000 over the age of 50, our members between the ages of 50 and 64 are especially concerned about finding affordable health care coverage. And they're very concerned about maintaining strong consumer protections that are currently available to Minnesota residents. First, I want to start by saying that AARP is very supportive of efforts at the national level to reform our healthcare system. And we believe that it is absolutely necessary that Congress act now to make healthcare more affordable and accessible and provide good quality coverage to those who do not currently have it and to include consumer protections every step of the way. Federal health care reform proposals currently being considered do contain provisions that allow for interstate sales of health insurance by private insurance companies. AARP, however, believes there could be a few potential problems if it moves forward. Our concern actually centers around the potential loss of long-standing consumer protections currently guaranteed by Minnesota law. Existing state law is the result of many years of careful deliberations by the legislature and the Minnesota Department of Commerce. All insurers in Minnesota must provide coverage to individuals and small employer groups that meet our state's minimum standards. The premiums they charge are reviewed and regulated. State regulators oversee the marketing of products by insurance companies and serve to protect consumers from fraudulent or misleading marketing. If an insurance company tries to terminate a policy when someone is sick or injured, or refuses to pay for necessary medical care, state agencies and our state court system are there to protect consumers. State regulators also ensure that insurance companies that want to do business in Minnesota are reputable and financially well-funded and stable. Minnesota should be very cautious in opening our doors to insurance companies that are not licensed here, are not under the control of our Commerce Department, are not answerable in our courts, and are not required to meet all of the standards set by Minnesota law and regulations. If interstate sales are allowed, Minnesota state agencies and courts should not be powerless to protect consumers from an out-of-state insurance company that goes bankrupt or refuses to pay for life or death surgery. Additionally, an out-of-state insurance company could use high-pressure sales tactics to peddle insurance that sounds like a good deal, but which actually offers little coverage and poor value. And a particular note, those who find out that they do not have the coverage they thought that they had could end up relying on Minnesota's medical program or uncompensated care to get the medical care they need, thus increasing costs to the state. If interstate sales of health insurance are allowed, AARP believes that insurance companies should be required to offer coverage that equals or exceeds current Minnesota standards. We also believe, and will work towards this end at both the state and the federal level, that strong consumer protections must be in place to protect Minnesota consumers, and indeed all consumers nationwide, when an out-of-state insurer acts badly or fails to deliver. For example, we are pleased that current federal legislation, the House bill in particular at the federal level, and what we're seeing in the Senate bill would allow Minnesotans to seek redress in the state's court system from an out-of-state insurer. Furthermore, final federal legislation should include a national minimal standard and additional protections that would bar insurance companies from denying coverage on the basis of age or pre-existing conditions. Again, I do want to just take a moment to note that if we do participate in an existing contract from a health insurance perspective, I know we currently do this for life insurance and for long-term care insurance, but if we do participate in a multi-state compact for health insurance, we should insist that the tenants of this compact for health insurance meet or exceed Minnesota's strong consumer standards. This is exceptionally important because we have the strongest standards in the country. And so we don't want to go backwards. We want to maintain what we have and even move it forward. Again, Chairman Huntley and Atkins, thank you very much, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify here today about this important issue, and we look forward to working with you as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kimball. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The next on our list is Ms. Aberholden from NAMI of Minnesota. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious about questions. I just want to make sure Ms. Kimball doesn't go too far. I have a couple questions for her related to AARP and insurance.
Okay. And we're going to circle back with questions once we get through the testimony. So you can, Ms. Kimball, if you can just, are you able to stay with us for the, if you can just stay till the end, we'll take some questions once we get through. We've got a couple more testifiers, and then we'll come back and take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sue Aberholden. I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And we seek to improve the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families by providing education, support, and advocacy. And I'm here to testify against allowing plans from other states to be able to sell to consumers here in Minnesota. You know, right now there's a lot of discussion and education about the race to the top. And I think when we start talking about allowing insurance from other states to be sold here, we're talking about a race to the bottom. Why would we want to allow insurance companies to be exempt from our state laws governing both the insurance company and the policies that they sell? And why would we want to allow companies to sell substandard and deficient health insurance policies, particularly plans that do not cover mental health services? I think it's clear that one of the first mandates that would be dropped would be mental health and chemical dependency services. And by allowing insurance companies to not offer mental health services, you're truly discriminating against a huge portion of the population, one in four adults and one in 10 children. And you're actually pushing the results of untreated mental illness onto taxpayers through increased utilization of state hospitals, jails, and our prisons. In Minnesota, we cover children's residential services, for example. A lot of other states do not have that covered under their state regulatory schemes. And so, you know, what will happen there in terms of families being able to afford residential treatment for their children? Minnesota policies generally cover mental health crisis teams, which really prevents a lot of unnecessary hospitalizations, save overall health care costs there. You know, we have, I don't know if any of you have ever had a self-insured plan or a plan that doesn't cover mental health services, but I'm just here to tell you that it's extremely costly when that happens. When my daughter had her suicide attempt, she was under a self-insured plan, and they would not cover the emergency room because they couldn't decide whether it was behavioral health care, although she would have blown out her liver if they had not provided treatment. They paid 60% of her hospitalization. If she had had appendicitis, they would have paid 90. And they allowed 3 therapy visits afterwards, which, of course, at the, you know, age of 13, she was going to need more than 3 therapy visits. And so just as a family member, as a mom, I did, of course, you know, go into debt because what else are you going to do when your child is ill? But you never know this. You don't know this until this happens to you. So, you know, I had read our policy. I had no idea it didn't cover mental health services in the same way. And so then you're going to get an out-of-state policy, and you're going to have an even harder time figuring out, you know, what it covers and what it doesn't cover. The other thing I want to mention is that NAMI and other groups have relationships with our Minnesota-based insurance companies. We all work together as part of the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group to figure out, you know, how both public and private dollars could be used to improve our mental health system and to be more efficient and effective. When something goes wrong, when someone calls our office, and we get over 4,000 calls a year, someone calls our office and they're having a problem with their health plan, I actually know who to call. So when one insurance company, for example, decided that they were going to have people use their credit card to make appointments for their psychiatrist because they had a lot of missed appointments, we were able to call and say, you know, a lot of people with bipolar disorder really don't want to have credit cards. Because in the manic phase, they could, you know, rack up a whole lot of debt. And so there's some other way to deal with it. If this was an out-of-state company, I may never figure out who it is that I can call to try to, you know, kind of get rid of those problems and to solve them. So I'm really concerned about what would happen. So, again, I'm not an insurance expert by any means, but all I can tell you is that if you allow plans from out-of-state, they're not going to cover mental health benefits. And then I'm going to be coming here, especially to the Human Services Committee, saying, you know, we need to fund mental health services for those who don't get it covered under their own plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Averholden. Next up is Ms. Perriott from the American Cancer Midwest Division. Ms. Perriott, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Atkin, and Chair Huntley, and members of the committee. My name is Ruth Perriott. I'm Vice President for Government Relations for the Midwest Division of the American Cancer Society. And we, too, are here as a constituent-based organization to express our concerns about potential interstate sale of health insurance products. I won't belabor some of the points that my predecessors have gone over, but it goes without saying that cancer patients can really need every part of a healthcare system. And as we have waded into debates about access to healthcare, what we have come to find is it isn't just about having insurance, it's about having adequate insurance. A clear example of a patient giving us a call who's having a problem might be that she found out once she had breast cancer that her insurance plan would pay for the removal of that cancer, but then would not pay for the follow-up MRIs that are necessary for breast cancer survivor to monitor the potential recurrence because that was deemed prevention and screening rather than treatment of the original cancer. These are some of the barriers cancer patients find themselves coming up against with inferior insurance products. As a result, in a survey of cancer patients that we conducted just this year, we found that 40% of families who have a person in their family experiencing cancer have difficulty paying for the complete treatment, and 25% of families with a person experiencing cancer have delayed or skipped treatment just in the past year. These are nationwide statistics. I'm proud that I'm a Minnesotan because we do have such a strong health insurance system and consumer protection here in Minnesota. We don't see nearly as many problems here with these limitations. And so it would concern us if the state opened the door up to some of these more inferior insurance products, and we would really urge careful consideration of any policy move in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perriott. And finally, in terms of folks who signed up to testify, we have Mr. Griffin from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Atkins, Chairman Huntley, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm a contract lobbyist, and I represent both UCARE and Preferred One in the health plan marketplace, but I'm speaking today on behalf of the 7-member nonprofit of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Mr. Chairman, members, we are deeply concerned about this proposal, and while without language, we cannot say whether we support or oppose such a language, we do have many concerns, and I want to address some of them. First, I'd like to just say that when we talk about the insurance compacts for things like life insurance, I want to just point out that life insurance is dramatically different from health insurance. This is not just a monetary payout based on death, but it's an ongoing system of funding, treatment and the care that people get. And for that reason, I would suggest that it's going to be much harder. And you heard the commissioner and the deputy commissioner talk about the difficulty of implementing this type of program. But I just want to highlight that for you. Mr. Chairman, members, Minnesota has succeeded in providing high-quality health care at lower costs than the rest of the nation, allowing for-profit health insurers to be subject to less stringent consumer protections and regulations by other states than Minnesota would disrupt what currently works here in our state. We don't think that this proposal does anything to reduce the underlying drivers of health care costs, such as paying for the services based on the quality of service rather than the quantity of service. I want you to be cautious as you look at the data that you have from the health department talking about mandates. The cost of an individual policy, if you look at the difference between one that includes maternity benefits and one that doesn't include maternity benefits, is very different than what happens on the group insurance side, and it shows you a lot more of what the real costs are. And there's a diagram in the handouts that Ms. Sonia gave to you today that talks about those differences. It's not 0 or 1% if you take it out. And if you go out, as I did, to try and buy an insurance policy individually, there's about a 10% difference between one that has maternity benefits and one that doesn't. I'd also like to say, when you talk about mandates, there are more than just two kinds of mandates, and Minnesota is full of them. Some of them we would say are not good, but some of them are very good. And some of the mandates that we have here really require a great deal more activity on the part of insurers than you would have from out-of-state insurers. And one of them that I will say that the provider community and the plans have worked very closely together on is the Administrative Uniformity Committee, which we have sat down month after month after month, year after year, to try and figure out ways of making the system work better for billing, for prior authorizations in the old days when we did a lot more prior authorization. And those kinds of things really are important to making our system work better. And when they talk about the minimum cost or minimal cost of any kind of a mandate, I'm taken back to one of the least pleasant memories that I have of lobbying around the state legislature back in 1985. And many of you have heard me probably more than you like. I know Chairman Huntley would probably like the amount of time that he's had to sit and listen to me oppose mandated benefits here in the legislature. It would probably be a very nice vacation for him. But I was sitting next to a witness, and we were testifying in the Senate on a bill requiring health plans to pay for cleft palate surgery. That is something that we have mandated in this state. And the young gentleman that I was sitting next to was insured by a self-insured employer. We found that out during the course of the hearing. He wouldn't have been affected by the legislation, but that is the kind of thing that you have passed in the state that I think you should be proud of and want to keep on the books and not allow it to go away. Mr. Chairman, members, we also passed some fairly major health care reform legislation in 2008. We're in the process of trying to implement that. The complexity of it is something that we've examined in numerous updated hearings, including several hours this morning, and it is something that is moving in the right direction. It may not all be perfect, and I may have some disagreements with the health department on what they're doing, but we don't think that you're going to be able to enforce that kind of health care reform if you pass this kind of bill that allows the sale of policies across state lines. Mr. Chairman, I'll leave with you and members of the committee a couple of handouts. One of them is from the New America Foundation study by Len Nichols that found that contrary to what the advocates of selling insurance across state lines claim, this policy really could actually lead to premiums that are higher. We believe Dr. Nichols is a reputable source, and we'd ask you to take a look at that as you move on. Let me point out just a few other things briefly. I know the time is short this afternoon, but Minnesota is a state which has chosen to fund some important state programs like Minnesota Care, Minnesota's high-risk pools. Those are things that we aren't sure quite how they fit into the mandated benefit system or how they work across state lines. But clearly, if you allow insurers from other states to come in here and sell policies that don't include those, you will put us at a very distinct competitive advantage. And if you want me to sell insurance that's cheaper, I can sell it much cheaper if I don't have to pay the MCHA assessment, if I don't have to pay the costs of Minnesota Care, if I don't have to pay for the Medicaid surcharge, if I don't have to pay the licensing fees, if I don't have to pay the per member per month policy cost that I pay here. Those add up to a significant amount of policy. The MCHA charge now is 2% per policy, and you can move from there. So that's a reason that we are in the marketplace selling policies, and insurers are looking at us and saying, is there a way to lower them? And when you say you can move to self-insurance, that is a very, very attractive thing for larger groups. But it would be very easy to do that in the small group market. And as you saw from the slides at the beginning of the Commerce Department presented, Senate, that group is eroding in the fully insured market. Mr. Chairman, I talked a little bit about some of the things like AUC that are going on, but there are some other unique things, and I want to just mention two others. One of them is the Minnesota Community Measurement Program, which is a hallmark in this nation of the kinds of things that we can do to actually measure and improve quality of care. It's not happening in Alabama. It's not happening in Mississippi. It's not happening in a lot of other states. And we would also point to the Institute for Clinical Systems Integration, ICSI, which you've heard about on numerous occasions. We don't know that insurers from other states would be required to participate in those, and it would be very difficult for them to do that from outside the state boundaries. Mr. Chairman, we are required as HMOs in the state to serve public program members under Rule 101. We don't know how that would work. If you don't remember what things were like in the early 1980s or the late 1970s when people could not find providers under public programs, that was why we moved to managed care, and it's one of the hallmarks of the managed care system working, is using our ability in the marketplace to work with providers to make sure that those programs do have providers available to people who need them. And last, but certainly not least, Mr. Chairman, you've heard it mentioned by the three prior testifiers, it's the consumer protection legislation that we have in the state and the ability of regulators and of others who work as advocates to work with plans to try and solve problems that we have. We think that that is a valuable thing that should be maintained regardless of where we go with health care reform. Mr. Chairman and members, those are some of the concerns that we have. We are anxious to look at the legislation when it's adopted. We know that we are going through changes. Our plea to you is not to say, let's maintain the status quo, everything's fine. We're quite well aware that there are problems in the healthcare system, some of them of our making, some of them of legislative making, many of them of the demands the consumers have on a system that can't do everything but is being asked to do it with limited expenditures. But Mr. Chairman and members, we continue to look forward to working with you to try and solve many of these problems, and hope that when this legislation comes before you, we'll have a chance to really look at the very rigorous details and go through this with you at that time. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. And I that actually concludes those that have signed up to testify. My guess is that we've got a few questions or comments, concerns from members. Representative Broad, you initially had, I think, a question for, was it Ms. Kimball? So Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I didn't realize I was going to get to you first, so I appreciate it. Ms. Kimball, I appreciate your testimony, and I think we agree on a number of things related to affordability and consumer protection. One of the things that I'm curious about, though, is that I was watching on TV one night, and I saw this wonderful AARP advertisement for an insurance product for its members, and I thought, you know, it was a great ad. But underneath the ad, it said it was United Healthcare was the provider of that insurance. And so I'm trying to understand how that works for your members to be able to have a product from United Healthcare, which is not available to other folks in Minnesota, if I'm correct. So I'm just trying to understand that dynamic.
Ms. Kimball?
That is an excellent question. It is a product that AARP endorses nationwide for our members. It is one of several products that are indeed offered. We do understand that that particular supplemental policy is not available necessarily to Minnesota members, but there are other supplemental policies that we recommend and that are available to our members here in Minnesota, but they are available. United Healthcare does provide the biggest insurance product for AARP nationwide.
Yes. Representative Broad?
Does that answer your...
Well, it does, yeah. I guess I was curious that would be advertising in Minnesota if the Minnesota members of AARP are not eligible to purchase that product. And so that was just... I guess it was just curious to me that... two things. One, that it would be advertising if it's not if they can't buy the product. But secondly, if they're able to buy the product, it was interesting to me that they could buy something that was essentially sold across state lines.
Ms. Kimball?
Yeah. I believe that when you saw that advertisement, I am thinking that it was on a national channel, such as CNN or A&E or HGTV, for example.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that Minnesotans were able to see it as well as those in Alabama or California or New York. And I apologize, the second part of your...
That answers the question. It was just a real interesting advertisement, but thanks so much.
Yes, and I should note that my office is not, my office here in Minnesota is strictly advocacy and education. We have absolutely nothing to do with our products or services that are provided. We have a very, very strong firewall between the two, so I don't even know when those advertisements are selling. I have nothing to do with that.
Thank you, Ms. Kimmel and Mr. Chairman. I'm just so hoping that the Minnesotans would be able to buy that product because it looked like a good one, but unfortunately it's not sold across state lines.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, who handed this? Oh, it was an article from the Star Tribune about the couple from East Bethel that was royally duped about their insurance.
I think
or non-insurance?
On behalf of the Council of Health Plans. Mr. Griffin, you're walking down. I'm guessing it was... your distribution.
Mr. Griffin, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Griffin, is it your intent to have this be an illustration of what would not be sold under this plan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, members, I apologize. I didn't get to my final page as I was scrolling down. And when I was talking about consumer protection, my point in handing that out, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, was to say that even with state regulation that we have and without the confusion that we think that might arise from selling policies across state lines, this is a television ad policy that was advertised. It's not insurance. And the person who purchased it is somebody who's been working in healthcare their whole life and was confused and ended up with something that isn't covered by regulation. And those are the kinds of dangers that we're worried about.
Mr. Chairman, so, Mr. Griffin, would this be the sort of thing like the AARP policy?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think this...
advertised like, nationally, same
yeah,
thing?
Yes, advertised nationally, but I don't think it's like the AARP policy. This really isn't even health insurance.
So why bring it up?
Mr. Chairman, the reason I brought it up is because I think it's illustrative of the confusion that's out there in the healthcare marketplace.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I ask you a question of Mr. Munson Regala, please? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Munson-Rodala, would the State Commerce Department, in your opinion, likely approve something that comes in the mail and says this is not an insurance card if the governor's proposed legislation were to pass?
Mr. Munson-Rodala?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, no.
Thank you.
Are there other questions or comments? Representative Bunn.
Thank you. This is also to Mr. Munson-Rodala. Or to another relevant person if somebody else has the information. In terms of you're doing your research to explore the governor's proposal and to come up with an outline for how to do this in Minnesota, did you look at the extent to which there are other states in the United States that currently have unilateral open door policies? And if so, can you tell us how many they are and what you learned about those states in terms of whether one can compare them to the states that don't have unilateral policies or you're not involved in any contacts at all in terms of how much lower premiums might be those states and also whether or not one could have quality data in those states versus the states that don't have a unilateral open door policy?
That is a great question. Mr. Munson-Rodala?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no state has enacted such a law. Roughly 15 states have introduced legislation that are going to be debated in their upcoming sessions relative to the implementation of a shared cost approach. They range in scale and scope from what I would deem a sort of total free trade zone approach, no standards relative to the selection of the policy. And as I hopefully explained, the governor's proposal is not that approach.
Mm-hmm.
The governor's approach tends to be focused on primarily product freedom, consumer protection, season assessments. Those elements still are going to be Minnesota centric. The folks that answered the 30,000 calls a year on my consumer response team from insurance consumers are going to get these calls. So they're going to be applying Minnesota law relative to consumer protection with respect to those companies. If, in fact, the plan were of the type that appears to be discussed by some of the proponents, we wouldn't like it either. We're focused on trying to present a plan that provides some degree of flexibility relative to the plan design. The consumer protection, speech and assessment, policy protection still remain Minnesota's plan.
Okay. Representative Bunn.
Two types of follow-up questions. One is on the issue of consumer protections. It's my understanding that in some states currently, in a small or individual market, small group or individual market, one could buy a policy where you've experienced an episode of cancer, then after you've experienced it and you've been treated for that one episode, they could drop your policy even though you were willing to continue. In other states, not talking about Minnesota, I'm talking about elsewhere. Maybe I'm wrong on this, but this is my what I thought was true. But that in Minnesota you couldn't do that, and that was one of the types of consumer protections we had here, that as long as you continue paying your premiums, you know, no one can drop you from your policy. Is it true that there are some differences across states in things like that? So maybe I'm misinformed because I saw someone shaking your head back there. And if so, if it's not true, then the whole line of argument goes away here. But if it were true, when you say that we would apply Minnesota consumer protection still, would we be screening against some things like that at the point of whether or not we allow that, you know, we look at the business model they have and the products and whatever, would they be screened for things like that, or would there just be, you know, full information to the consumer about that feature of the plan and they would need to be aware of that? That's the one question. The second question is, when there is a consumer problem, and as you said, currently part of the consumer advocates that we hear from Dave believe that there is, it's easier to deal with those consumer problems if it's within your own state because we know who to call, or there are our own ADs, glass, our own courts, and our own Commerce Department dealing with it. If you had consumer problems with a policy that wasn't out of state, I mean, what do you foresee is the additional challenges that will pose in terms of getting action on that through the courts or through the ADs or where the normal channels are compared to what process that currently exists?
Mr. Gala,
Mr. Representative. We should clarify, we already have out-of-state companies selling insurance products. In mm-hmm. Those products are currently drafted pursuant to Minnesota law. And I envision the operational challenge for my team, if this law were to pass, is that they're going to have to read a policy that's drafted in a way that's not familiar to them. And having said that, my team reviews contracts every day, looks at the set of facts and determines whether or not set of facts, the application of the facts to the contract language drive a certain result. And I will, at the risk of blowing our own horn, we do that fairly successfully. On average, we generate somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million in additional payments to consultants every year. As a result of our reviewing contract language, looking at the facts and making a determination that in fact the claim merits some additional payment. So that's from our perspective, that's where we view sort of the operational issue relative to the implementation of the proposal. With respect to your comment about the ability to cancel a non-renewal policy in the event of a significant claim relative to I believe it was cancer. I'll have to have John Gross chime in on what our law is, but one of the things we should, the wild card in all of this is what's happening in the Senate right now. Some of those standards relative to guaranteed renewal, no lifetime limit, rescission, those are going to trump whatever our standard is relative, whether it's less or higher. So some of the, I would say some of our responses to what happen relative to those standards is going to be a lot of them.
Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman, I'm a member of the committee. I'm John Gross, Director of Healthcare Policy. Basically, I think what you're talking about is rescission. The person buys the policy is canceled later on. In Minnesota, many states have what is called an incontestability clause, meaning if you lie on the application, you say, I don't have cancer, I don't have this, I don't have that, they don't go out and do a physical on you. They don't, they just rely on that app. So everybody has the right to rescind the policy if it's very black and white that you lied on the application. What I think is important to establish here, and again, and I call it Minnesota Nice, is Minnesota's companies look at that, and if it's gray, they issue the policy. But if the person that fibs on that app is discovered later on when they have the claim, they're going to rescind it. And unfortunately, they return the premium, and the claim is unpaid. We have very, very few complaints on this in Minnesota, mainly because I think people are honest when they fill out the application. They understand the ramifications of...
Mr. Gross, if I might, I don't think that was exactly the point of the question. You might want to have Representative Bunn reiterate what the question was so that we can get it. Maybe I'm wrong, but Representative Bunn, I'll let you try to reiterate it.
Yeah, that wasn't my question or the example I was giving. And the example I give may be fallacious. This is one I'd heard in a couple of years since I've been here. It had not to do with rescission based on what you revealed in your application. I mean, it's like when you have multiple tickets or multiple car accidents and your insurance company decides to drop you from your car insurance just because they think your future does not look promising in terms of you're going to be a high-cost insurer. They could either try to bump up your rate or they could just say we're not covering you anymore. I thought, not in Minnesota, but that elsewhere, if you had some high-cost health episodes, you'd nothing about lying on applications, and they did pay for them because you have insurance, but then they wouldn't renew your insurance, even though you were willing to continue paying premiums. And I thought that one example of the differences between what Minnesota requires in consumer protections and some other states don't was that we did not allow that in our state, but some other states did, and that some of the kinds of consumer protections that people were concerned about losing if we opened up to other states.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, basically every state has to have in their individual products a guarantee renewability provision, and the policy is good until you're covered by Medicare. So conceivably, you have claims, you have this and that, the company cannot non-renew you individually. The company can certainly raise the rates, but again, it's not going to be predicated on your individual losses and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If I may, I can answer Representative Broad's question, too.
What the heck? Go for it, Mr. Gross.
United Healthcare is a big conglomerate located in Minnetonka, Minnesota. Pays a lot of good taxes here, but they own two small insurance companies. One is called United Healthcare. It used to be Hartford. It's licensed here. The only thing they ever sell is their Medicare products. They have, and they have another dinky little insurance company in Onalaska, Wisconsin, and again, that has very, very minimal amount of premium volume here.
Yeah, that's what we thought up here too. But and Chair Huntley, you had a question or comment or both?
Comments and a couple of questions. In terms of rescission, there was a famous case nationally, not in Minnesota, where a 35-year-old woman was rescinded her health insurance because she had failed to tell them that she was treated for acne when she was a teenager. And so then she got cancer, I think, and that's what the insurance company tried to do. My question for Mr. Munson-Regala is the new federal law that requires mental health parity, what is that going to do in Minnesota?
Munson-Regala?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, I don't think any impact would be in Minnesota because our law far exceeds the standards that the federal mental health parity law has. The federal mental health parity law has some opt-outs where if the costs go up X percent, then the plan doesn't have to comply with it. We do not permit that, so we've got a heck of a better standard for mental health parity in Minnesota than we do nationally.
My last question, how many health insurance companies for profit sell in Minnesota? Not the percentage of the market, just roughly.
Mr. Ross?
I would say 100 or more. There's, again, when we talk about health insurance, we might be talking about somebody that's selling the cancer-only policy, the Medicare supplements, the disability income, but when you're talking about regular health insurance, I would say maybe about 50. We've got two big ones. One is in Des Moines called Principal. We've got Federated out of Owatonna. They sell a heck of a lot of insurance here. It just they don't make the radar scope.
Thank you.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate all the information we're getting here today. It's really good. I have a question, and then but also I reread again because of the kinds of questions we've had here, that if in the governor's proposal, I believe this is, yes, that if something were sold in Minnesota, there's 4 points here. They have to have a certificate of authority, accredited, must agree to abide by Minnesota's claims practices and other consumer protection laws, to insurance company has to be subject to standard Minnesota fees and taxes and so on, and only policies approved in those states and meeting Minnesota's new criteria could be sold in Minnesota. So I think this is a very strong statement that whatever is done outside of Minnesota, if you're coming here from another state, you have to comply with Minnesota standards. And I just want to affirm, I've got it in writing here, so I believe that is the case. Should be a short answer. So the other thing that I have a question on is, do you have materials that would, a question that I have is, if you have the same benefit set in another state as you do in Minnesota, what might be the insurance premiums when you have those same benefit sets, no matter which company it's from? In other words, it is this benefit set, because I was reading this list here, several states have very similar benefit sets, or, you know, you have those going on. And so I think in a comparison thing, is it cheaper in another state or more expensive in Minnesota? Cheaper in Minnesota, more expensive in another state? Do you have anything at all that does a comparison and that kind of criteria?
Mr. Munson-McGill.
We do not have apples-to-apples comparisons. We have high-level cost of insurance for family or individual policies. We can do comparisons relative to, if we strip down and compare the benefits so that they're exactly aligned the same. And I assume you're limiting it to the fully insured marketplace. There's got to be some degree of similarity in the self-insured marketplace, because they can do a self-insured plan that looks the same in more than a few states. I suspect we're not going to find a benefit design set in another state that looks exactly like the Minnesota policy. So we might not have a true apples-to-apples comparison. Now, we've been asked, so then why would a company want to consider selling a plan from another state here? In visiting with some of the fully insured companies, one of the common things they came up with is there might be some advantages relative to, for example, the systems you set up to support those plans. It's not that the design set is worse. I suppose we'll argue about that. But the design set that they have a system that's claim system, underwriting system, marketing structure, compliance structure that they already have in place to deal with the plan that they know is finds the marketplace in the state that they want to sell it from. I suspect from talking to a number of insurers, yes, there are going to be concerns about additional mandates. But their concern is about the frictional difference created by the differences between the states, which is part of the reason we want to talk about a compact, create a uniform standard so that the company can sell one product across a number of different states. And to respond to some of the concerns about the compact, I'm glad that AARP brought up that, you know, consumer protection should be part of any compact proposal, because AARP is part of our Consumer Advisory Committee. They are part of the process of helping promulgate our standards. I'm glad that Mr. Griffin pointed out that, you know, one of the differences between the compact and health is that health relates to a long-term relationship involving a design set of benefit payments over time. Well, the compact also covers long-term care, benefits over time. It covers annuities. Annuities include lifetime benefits, payments over a regular stream of time, and it also includes disability payments over time. So I would posit that the current compact approach provides an opportunity for us and other states, and by the way, the reactions from other states were interesting. The reaction from some states was that we weren't going farther enough with our compact proposal. They thought our compact proposal should focus on things like network adequacy and reimbursement structures, that the real savings was in figuring out a way to impose an AUC type of an approach relative to electronic transmissions and standards across all the states who are members of the compact. But anyway, be that may, we suggest that there is some ability to hold down the cost of insurance in our state, or to moderate the rate of increase in those costs if we create an opportunity for competition to increase here, either to the industry folks or to the contract.
Thank you. We've got Representative Anderson, Representative Root, and then I sort of promised folks about 4:15 we'd be wrapping up, so I'd like to abide by that. You already got a couple of chances, Representative Broad, goodness sakes. You got the first word, you want the last word, too? What I suggest is that again, as I said earlier, it's sort of an introduction of a topic that I'm gathering we're going to hear plenty more about, and I appreciate everybody that came and testified to sort of give us, even I was going to say the 30,000-foot level, but we've gotten down to like 15 feet off the ground, too. And some, so it's been a very valuable opportunity. With that, I'll go to Representative Anderson and Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Mine is just a request for information. I've looked at the list of mandates, both the ones that are in the 26 other states and the ones that are found in less than 24 states. And some of these, I'm not quite sure what they are, and it would be helpful if I could get just a one sentence of exactly what each one of these mandates do. So I noticed that there's two reconstructive surgery mandates in here. One is for breast reconstruction, and then the other one, I don't know what all that entails. And so if we could get that information, I'm not on the health committee, so I don't delve in these issues every day, but I think it would be helpful for me to see that. And just also, too, Mr. Chair, at some point, have greater conversation about the fact that Minnesota is number two when it comes to premium costs for families in the nation. And I think that's a huge concern, and its mandates don't play a role in the cost of insurance in the state of Minnesota. What does? So.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question from Mr. Muncy-Nagala. Do you have any way to anticipate the number of new products that may be marketed then in Minnesota? And I ask that because you mentioned your staff got 30,000 calls this past year. So I'm wondering, how big is your staff? Because I know as a consumer myself, it's very frustrating when you want to get an answer about insurance. I think it is important for the consumer to make sure that they have access to information if they need it.
Ms. Munson-McGill.
Thank you, Chair Rutherford. We have roughly, in the Commerce Department, 90 people assigned to insurance issues. On my consumer response team, those are the folks that wear the headsets and walk around, still call every day. There are roughly 10 of those individuals. We also have, in addition to them, a staff of insurance investigators and insurance examiners. So, for example, if we find a pattern developing in the nature of the complaints or calls we're getting, we can open up a microtonic exam and do a more extensive review of the company's business practices as opposed to one-off. And just to clarify, when I say 30,000, I'm not suggesting that 30,000 complaints. And if I gave you that impression, my apologies. The majority of our calls are primarily information only. Mm-hmm. They want to understand what does this provision in the policy mean. Mm-hmm. And we have that conversation with consumers every day. We're also trying to figure out ways to be more proactive relative to consumer education, including some of the more modern social media, so as consumer education, scares of sound, giving to the Department of Commerce on YouTube and Facebook, and places where consumers are getting information.
Yeah, well, Representative or Commissioner Wilson's back there Twittering or tweeting right now, I think. Representative Rood, did you have any?
Is there any way to anticipate how many new products would be marketed in Minnesota? How many companies you figure conversations with different groups, I guess?
We've talked to some of the publishers, and we've talked to a number of our domestics also. We would also note, and this is one thing the domestics perhaps have not figured out until we visited with them, that they too, to the extent that they are writing in other states, like say Iowa, and they like the Iowa plan, for example, in the localities that border Iowa, and they think that plan somehow has some benefit to being marketed in Minnesota across borders, they too could sell that plan here. So that's perhaps one of the more common things we have to knock down pretty quick when we mess with the domestic.
is to point out, now I understand that doesn't help a domestic that doesn't buy things like those, which we can see that. But the ones that do, if there's a plan that particularly there is a provider that does business across the border, the provider, I think, would love that ability to know exactly what the benefit structure looks like, irrespective of whether that person is getting treated in their South Dakota branch or in their Minnesota branch.
It's an interesting issue, though, and it's, I'd be curious if there'd be a fiscal note associated with the because you go from regulating a small handful of folks to suddenly dozens or scores of products from across the nation. It's more of a curiosity and a beginning of a conversation. Representative Broad, I gave you a hard time, but you get the final question or word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank you, Chair Atkins and Chair Huntley, for holding the hearing. I think this is obviously a very important issue. One of the things that I just wanted to point out in terms of a comment before we finish is that, you know, with there being a proposal for interstate sales in the House bill and a proposal for interstate sales in the Senate bill, it seems to me it's less a matter of whether and a matter of more a matter of how. And so as we look at the issue, my hope is that, my personal opinion is that the state should absolutely be in the driver's seat. And, you know, the House version has the NAIC, and with all due respect to the NAIC, I think it's much better in the hands of a legislative body, and that's why I think the idea of an interstate compact that is actually passed by legislatures as opposed to insurance commissioners, I think is a much better approach. And so I just wanted to throw that out there. For me, it's less a matter of when and more a matter of how, and we can either do it right or not. And so I hope that legislatures are in the driver's seat. We can do that through that interstate compact, which is housed at the Council of State Governments. We are all members of the Council of State Governments. In fact, the Council of State Governments has passed a resolution setting up a working group to discuss the idea of an interstate compact, and I just wanted to put that on the table as well.
Do we have any members who are on that, Representative Broad?
Well, gosh, Chair Atkins, we happen to have a few members on that committee, so.
Thank you all very much for your attendance. Appreciate your time. Wish you all a wonderful holiday, Merry Christmas, Kwanzaa, Solstice, whatever you celebrate, and we'll see you after the first of the year. With that, we stand adjourned.